They sang in the mountains, barefoot and bloodstained. They burned plantations, danced with spirits, and wrote freedom with their bodies. While the world remembered colonial kings and governors, the Caribbean remembered rebels. This is not a story about empire. It's about defiance. From the Maroon Hills of Jamaica to the slave armies of Haiti, this is the untold truth of the warriors who dared to rise, and the cultural legacy they left behind. You may not know their names, but they built the future in fire. This is Caribbean History, the untold lives of Caribbean freedom fighters, a cinematic, investigative deep dive into the voices the empire tried to erase. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Long before sugarcane fields stained with blood, before shackles clinked against brown skin, before maroons carved nations in the hills and Toussaint ignited revolution, there was Otway, a Taino cacique from the island of Hispaniola. Otway wasn't born into war. He was born into rhythm, a world of island identity, indigenous culture, and ancestral balance. The Caribbean was not always a land of chains and fire. It was once a network of complex societies, with sacred languages, communal farming, spiritual ceremonies, and rich ecological systems that connected human life to land, sea, and sky. It was a world rooted in indigenous resistance, not by design, but by necessity. But then came the ships, and with them, the legacy of slavery. Otway watched as Spanish conquistadors tore through Hispaniola like a plague. He saw his people enslaved under the system of encomienda, an early blueprint for plantation oppression. Bodies piled, forests burned, gods abandoned. And in that trauma, something ancient awakened inside him. A cultural resistance not just of weapons, but of memory. When he fled to Cuba in 1511 with 400 warriors, he carried more than just arms. He carried the first spark of Caribbean rebellion. When Otway arrived in Cuba, he didn't plead. He didn't negotiate. He warned. In a now legendary moment recorded by Spanish friar Bartolomé de las Casas, Otway gathered the Taino people of Cuba and held up a basket of Spanish gold. Then he asked, "Do you know why they come here? They come for this. They worship this more than they worship their God, and for this they will destroy us all." He urged them to fight, to burn the gold, to remember who they were. It was the first decolonial speech in Caribbean history, and it cost him everything. The war that followed was brief but furious. Otway's fighters, armed with spears, stones, and ancestral spirit, used guerrilla tactics to resist the Spanish. They struck from the forests, disappeared into mountains, and used the land as their shield, long before the Maroons of Jamaica or the rebels of Saint Domingue. But Spanish firepower, cannons, dogs, steel, was too great. Otway was eventually captured, bound, and sentenced to be burned alive. Yet even in death, he rebelled. As legend goes, a Spanish priest offered him baptism before the fire. If he accepted, the priest said he could go to heaven. Otway asked, "Are there Spaniards in your heaven?" "Yes," the priest replied. "Then I do not wish to go there," Otway said. And with that, he died in flames, refusing their God, their heaven, and their history. Otway was not a footnote. He was the first martyr of Caribbean freedom, a symbol of what it meant to resist not just with arms, but with identity, memory, and meaning. His story would echo across the centuries, in the mountains of Jamaica with Queen Nanny, in the sugar fields of Barbados with Boussa, and in the courts of colonial law with Paul Bogle. He showed that resistance begins with rejection, the refusal to accept the world your oppressors build for you. Today, Otway is honored in Cuba as a national hero. His name lives in cigars, monuments, and myth. But far more importantly, his spirit lives in every act of cultural preservation, every indigenous voice that speaks its name, every fire that still burns against injustice in the Caribbean. He was the first, but he would not be the last. In the blue-green hills of the Jamaican interior, where mists curl like ancestral breath and the rivers run through time, a woman once stood with fire in her eyes and war in her heart. They called her Nanny, Queen Nanny of the Maroons. But she was more than a leader. She was an embodiment of spiritual resistance, a cultural custodian, and a living echo of Africa's defiance in the face of colonial cruelty. Her real name is unknown. Her early years are hidden in the smoke of slavery. But legend says she came from the Ashanti people, born in Ghana, brought to Jamaica in chains. Yet somehow she escaped, into the mountains, into freedom. From there, she didn't just survive. She built a nation. By the early 1700s, Jamaica had become a furnace of exploitation. The British plantation economy, fueled by sugar and slave labor, had turned the island into a graveyard for African souls. But deep in the Blue Mountains, a different Jamaica was taking root. A Jamaica not of empire, but of cultural fusion, cultural transformation, and cultural resistance. The Maroons, descendants of escaped slaves, formed settlements in the wild. They refused colonial rule. They preserved their Afro-Caribbean identity, their languages, their music, their beliefs. And at the center of this defiant world was Nanny. Queen Nanny's rebellion wasn't just political, it was spiritual. She was known as an Obia woman, a priestess, a master of African warfare and metaphysics. Her command of nature, strategy, and community bonded the Maroons into an unbreakable force. Oral history says she could catch bullets with her hands, that she spoke with ancestors, that she summoned the dead. But even stripped of myth, her real power was undeniable. She trained warriors. She led ambushes. She used the land like a weapon. Nanny Town, her mountain stronghold, was a fortress of freedom, invisible to the British and impenetrable by force. From there, she launched a campaign of guerrilla warfare that terrified the empire. Maroon fighters struck with precision, then vanished into the mist. They burned plantations, liberated captives, dismantled the illusion of colonial control. It was resistance as sacred duty, and Nanny was its beating heart. For over three decades, Queen Nanny held off British soldiers using no army but the enslaved and escaped. She wasn't given authority by title or decree. Her leadership was organic, rooted in ancestral respect and revolutionary need. She embodied cultural preservation, indigenous identity, and transformative change in ways few Caribbean figures ever have. Eventually, the British gave up. In 1739 and 1740, they signed treaties with the Maroons, recognizing their autonomy, granting them land, and agreeing to peace. It was the first time the British Empire was forced to sign a peace agreement with formerly enslaved people in the New World. The treaty was imperfect and controversial, but it was also proof. Nanny won. Today, Queen Nanny is one of Jamaica's seven national heroes. She is the only woman on the list. Her face appears on the $500 Jamaican dollar note. Her name echoes in schools, songs, and mountains. But more importantly, her legacy lives in the very DNA of resistance that still pulses through the Caribbean. She reminds us that freedom is not given, it's made. Forged in fire, guided by spirit, held by blood, Queen Nanny was more than a rebel. She was the mother of a Caribbean nation within a nation, and she proved that even the most marginalized voices can build empires of their own. The Caribbean has known many rebellions, but only one gave birth to a nation. And at its heart stood a man once enslaved, armed not with chains but with vision. Toussaint Louverture was born into bondage in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, today known as Haiti, the blood diamond of the Caribbean, its soil richer than any other, its cruelty deeper than any wound. The island was the crown jewel of the French Empire, producing more sugar, more coffee, and more suffering than anywhere else in the Western Hemisphere. It was a place where death was common and dignity was forbidden. But something extraordinary was buried under that soil. Black heritage, cultural identity, and a revolutionary soul that refused to die. Toussaint was born around 1743, the son of an educated African father believed to be of noble lineage. Though enslaved, he was unusually literate, multilingual, and deeply spiritual, steeped in Catholicism, Vodou, and Enlightenment philosophy alike. He studied history, medicine, and military tactics in secret. His mind, sharp and restless, became a weapon long before he ever took up arms. When the fire came in 1791, he was ready. That year, the enslaved population of Saint-Domingue rose up in one of the most dramatic and successful slave revolts in human history. Fueled by the horrors of plantation life, inspired by the rhetoric of the French Revolution, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, and ignited by Vodou ceremonies in the forests, thousands set plantations ablaze. This was not merely a riot, it was a war. And Toussaint Louverture, once known as a stable master, became its commander. He led his forces with terrifying precision, combining guerrilla tactics, European military strategy, and spiritual belief systems into a revolutionary force. But Toussaint's war was not only about vengeance. It was about transformative change, about the birth of a new society built not on racial hierarchy but on human dignity. He negotiated with France. He outwitted Spain. He played Britain against its enemies. And for a moment in history, Toussaint ruled most of Saint-Domingue as governor, abolishing slavery, restructuring the economy, and even drafting a constitution. A black man, born enslaved, was now leading the richest colony in the world. It was cultural revolution, political struggle, and identity rebirth all at once. But empires never forgive those who outshine them. In 1802, Napoleon Bonaparte sent a massive expedition to crush the Black Revolution. Toussaint, betrayed during peace talks, was kidnapped and shipped to a freezing prison in the French Alps. He died there in 1803, starved, alone, and surrounded by snow. His final words: "In overthrowing me, you have cut down only the trunk of the tree of black liberty. It will spring back from the roots, for they are many and they are deep." And he was right. Less than a year later, his generals, Jean-Jacques Dessalines among them, completed the revolution. On January 1, 1804, Haiti became the first black republic in the world, the first nation born from a successful slave revolt, and a beacon of hope for oppressed peoples across the globe. Haiti's liberation sent shockwaves through the Caribbean. British colonies tightened laws. Jamaican Maroons were more closely watched. Plantation masters across the region panicked. But for the Afro-Caribbean, the message was clear. Freedom was not a fantasy. It was possible. Toussaint's dream lived beyond his death. In music, in language, in resistance movements that rippled across the hemisphere. His story became a cinematic legacy of what it means to reclaim identity, heritage, and sovereignty by force and by faith. He proved that no empire, no matter how rich or brutal, could suppress the power of a people united by vision and spirit. In the Caribbean's southern crescent, nestled between volcanic peaks and fertile plantations, the island of Grenada was once a powder keg. It was a crossroads of empire, shaped by French and British hands, soaked in the blood of the enslaved and ready to erupt. And in 1795, it did. At the center of that explosion stood Julien Fedin, a man of mixed African and French heritage, son of a formerly enslaved African woman and a free French planter. He was not born a slave nor entirely accepted as elite. Instead, he lived between two worlds, a contradiction molded by colonial history, race, and revolution. And from that tension, he became a warrior, Grenada's Black Jacobin. The late 18th century was a time of transformative change across the Atlantic. The American Revolution had already sparked new ideas about freedom. The French Revolution was in full fury, beheading kings and birthing republics. And on the nearby island of Saint-Domingue, enslaved Africans were setting the colonial order on fire under Toussaint Louverture. Grenada too was restless. Though ruled by the British, its people were largely French-speaking, Catholic, African, and Creole. Many of them, especially in the countryside, still identified with France. And more importantly, with French ideals. Liberty, equality, fraternity. Fedin was among them. He had studied the Enlightenment. He believed in emancipation, in cultural transformation, and in the power of revolution to correct injustice. But the British governed Grenada with cold efficiency, denying rights, deepening slavery, and silencing dissent. The enslaved were brutalized. Free people of color like Fedin were marginalized. The island was rich in sugar, spice, and pain. And so, in March of 1795, Fedin struck. The rebellion began with a bold move. Fedin and his rebels attacked the town of Grenville, killing British officials and declaring revolutionary justice. Within weeks, nearly half of Grenada was under rebel control. Plantations burned. Enslaved Africans joined the uprising. Fedin's army grew, a fusion of freedmen, Maroons, and former slaves, all united by the dream of liberation. His headquarters at Belvedere Estate, high in the mountains, became a cultural stronghold of the revolution. There, the rebels operated like a shadow republic, holding court, declaring laws, executing traitors. Fedin styled himself after the revolutionaries of France, calling for the end of slavery, racial equality, and the creation of a black-led Grenadian republic. It was a vision years ahead of its time, and one that terrified the British. The British responded with brutal force. they declared martial law, recruited militias, and brought in reinforcements from neighboring islands. The rebellion turned into a war of attrition. The British suffered major defeats early on, even losing their governor in an ambush. But their superior numbers and resources gradually turned the tide. By 1796, Feidun's forces were cornered. His allies executed. His army thinned. But Feidun himself was never captured. He vanished into the mountains, into history's shadows. Some say he died in battle. Others believe he escaped to South America. His body was never found. His revolution unfinished. Still, Feidun's war left a scar on colonial rule. It was the largest and most organized rebellion in Granada's history. It exposed the fragility of empire and inspired future generations of Afro-Caribbean resistance. It also left behind something harder to erase. A legacy of memory, a sense that Granada's soil had once nourished revolution. Today, Julian Feidun is both a symbol and a question of what could have been, of freedom imagined but unrealized. His rebellion is rarely taught in textbooks, rarely honored in national holidays. But his story, his stand, deserves remembrance. Because Feidun believed what every freedom fighter believes, that identity is worth fighting for, that justice must rise from the ashes, that even the smallest island can become a battlefield for the soul of a people. Barbados, the birthplace of British sugar empire in the Caribbean, a paradise sold in travel brochures, but born from ash and iron. In the early 1800s, this small coral island was one of the wealthiest colonies in the British West Indies, built on the backs of tens of thousands of enslaved Africans. Barbados had no mountains to flee to, no thick jungle to hide in. It was a plantation grid, neat rows of sugar cane, scorched fields, and surveillance. For centuries, the people on this island were trapped in a cage with no door. And yet, even here, freedom took flame. His name was Boussa. Little is known about his early life. He was born in Africa or Barbados, possibly a headman on the Bailey Plantation in St. Philip. He held a position of minor authority, an enslaved man trusted by his overseers, allowed to move between estates. But Boussa was not loyal to his masters. He was loyal to his people. And in silence he plotted. In 1816, whispers moved across the island like wind through cane fields. Whispers of cultural awakening. Whispers of resistance. Whispers of a rebellion that would tear Barbados from the inside out. The enslaved believed, wrongly, that the British Parliament had already passed emancipation, but local planters were withholding their freedom. Fueled by this belief and by centuries of degradation, they organized. Boussa, along with leaders like Washington Franklin, Nanny Grig, and Jackie, planned a coordinated uprising during the Easter holiday, a time when plantation owners would be distracted. They mobilized rebels across multiple parishes, St. Philip, St. George, St. John, and beyond. Their plan was not chaos. It was war. On the night of April 14, 1816, Barbados ignited. Fires were lit. Cane fields burned. Slaves armed with cutlasses and courage rose against their masters. It was the largest slave revolt in Barbadian history. Over 20 plantations were engulfed in flames. Plantation houses were ransacked. Whips were dropped. Boussa's men moved quickly, strategically, inspired not just by pain, but by a vision of emancipation. But they were met with overwhelming force. The colonial government, well prepared and well armed, deployed troops and militias with guns, cannons, and ruthless orders. Within 3 days, the uprising was crushed. Over 200 rebels were killed. Boussa himself died in battle, likely during a final clash near Bailey's plantation. But the British didn't just stop the rebellion. They made an example. Hundreds were captured. Dozens were executed, hanged, beheaded, or shot. Many more were imprisoned or exiled. But even as they silenced the rebels, they couldn't silence the truth. The system was burning. The Boussa Rebellion didn't free Barbados. Slavery would continue until 1834. But it forced the world to listen. It shook the planters. It pressured Parliament. And it proved that Barbados, the loyal colony, was no longer obedient. In time, Boussa became a symbol. A whisper turned thunder. A legacy too large for chains. Today, he is honored as Barbados's first national hero. A towering statue, the Boussa Emancipation Monument, stands in Bridgetown, arms raised in victory. He is remembered in song, in story, in spirit. A man who, though enslaved, refused to kneel. Busa's stand was not in vain, because in the Caribbean, every fire feeds another. And the plantation inferno of 1816 became part of a larger blaze, one that would eventually consume the very institution of slavery itself. From the flat lands of Barbados to the mountainous terrains of Haiti and Jamaica, the struggle was the same. Dignity, defiance, freedom or death. Before it was Guyana, it was Berbice, a Dutch colony carved into South America's northeast coast, bordered by jungles, rivers, and the haunting silence of suffering. Here in 1763, long before the abolition movement, long before Toussaint or Busa, one of the earliest and most visionary uprisings in the Caribbean ignited, led by a man whose name would echo for centuries. Cuffy. Soldier. Iceman. And the dreamer of a black republic. The Dutch had turned Berbice into a plantation hell, extracting sugar, coffee, and human life from the rainforest. Thousands of enslaved Africans were imported to fuel the plantation economy, subjected to brutal punishment, starvation, and separation. There were no treaties, no freedom zones. Escape was met with death. But by 1763, the colony was stretched thin. Disease ravaged the settlers. Supplies were low. The enslaved outnumbered their masters. And one spark would light the fire. That spark began at Plantation Magdalenenburg on the Cange River, where enslaved Africans rose up in rebellion. Their ranks grew rapidly, swelling into the thousands, consuming estate after estate. As the Dutch faltered, the rebels gained ground. And into this chaos stepped Cuffy, a house slave from Plantation Lilienburg, believed to have been born in West Africa. He was no ordinary rebel. He was a tactician, a philosopher, a man with visionary leadership. Under Cuffy's command, the rebellion transformed from uprising to government. He organized fighters into regiments. He distributed resources. He established a capital at Plantation Hollandia, commanding from the heart of the colony. He issued letters, formed councils, and proposed a radical idea: that Berbice be split, one half for the Dutch, the other for the Africans. This was not mere resistance. This was nation-building. Cuffy sought not only to end slavery, but to create a society governed by African identity, rooted in equality, structure, and independence. It was the first recorded instance of a black-led provisional government in the Americas, predating the Haitian Revolution by decades. But like all bold visions, it faced bitter resistance. Internal divisions weakened the rebel ranks. Factions formed. Some rebel leaders, like Accra, clashed with Cuffy over strategy and power. As unity splintered, Dutch reinforcements from neighboring colonies arrived, bringing with them superior weapons, European soldiers, and brutal tactics. The rebellion, once unstoppable, began to crumble. Faced with betrayal and defeat, Cuffy is believed to have taken his own life in May 1763. He died not in battle, but in despair, watching the republic he tried to build dissolve under colonial fire and human ego. By 1764, the Dutch had crushed the uprising. Hundreds were executed, decapitated, burned alive, or hunted in the forests. But the rebellion left a permanent scar. It was the first serious threat to European rule in Guyana, and the memory of Cuffy would never be erased. Today, Cuffy is a national hero of Guyana. His image is etched in stone in the capital, Georgetown. His name is taught in schools, sung in poems, and invoked during Mashramani, the country's independence celebration. He represents a lost nation that nearly existed, a republic built by the enslaved for the enslaved, long before such ideas were accepted by the world. Cuffy's story is not just one of rebellion. It is a story of political imagination, identity rebirth, and cultural revolution, born in the jungle and burned into the soul of a people. Though Berbice fell, the dream did not. Because Caribbean freedom fighters weren't just warriors. They were architects of futures the world still fears. In the damp hills and sugar valleys of 1830s Jamaica, a new kind of rebellion was stirring. One that didn't begin with cutlasses or fire, but with the Bible. His name was Samuel Sharp. A man of deep faith, sharp intellect, and unwavering resolve. He was not born to fight with weapons. He chose to fight with words, sermons, and truth, until the empire left him no other choice. Sam Sharp was born enslaved in Montego Bay on the Croydon Plantation. But unlike many of his peers, he was literate, self-taught and deeply immersed in Christianity, especially the teachings of nonviolence and liberation. As a Baptist preacher and deacon, he became a respected leader among the enslaved, using Sunday meetings not just for scripture, but for strategy. Because Sharp, like many, had heard rumors. Rumors that slavery had already been abolished by Britain, but the colonial elite were hiding the news. It wasn't true, but it didn't need to be. For Sam Sharp, the point was simple. If slavery was immoral in London, it was immoral in Jamaica. And it had to end. So he began organizing a peaceful general strike, calling on enslaved people across Western parishes, from St. James to Trelawney, to stop working after Christmas of 1831 until they were paid wages. It was a bold, brilliant plan. A nonviolent protest on an island addicted to violent rule. But as history so often shows, colonial power fears even peaceful resistance. On December 27, 1831, the strike began. Thousands refused to work. Plantations ground to a halt. Tensions soared. When the colonial militia moved to crush the protest, violence erupted, not from Sharp but from the desperation of the enslaved. Fires were lit. Cane fields blazed. And so began the Baptist War, or the Christmas Rebellion, the largest slave uprising in British colonial history. Over 60,000 enslaved Jamaicans took part. They were not unorganized mobs. They were coordinated communities, moving with intention, leadership, and hope. Their rebellion, though met with swift repression, shook the foundations of empire. But British retaliation was vicious. Over 200 rebels were killed in battle. Another 310 were executed, many publicly, their bodies displayed as warnings. Churches were burned. Baptist missionaries accused of sedition were jailed or exiled. Sam Sharp, though never taking up arms, was arrested, tried, and sentenced to death. On the gallows in May 1832, his final words were, "I would rather die upon yonder gallows than live in slavery." And in that moment, Samuel Sharp became more than a man. He became a martyr. A symbol of cultural resistance, religious conviction, and righteous rebellion. The Christmas Rebellion didn't immediately end slavery, but it changed everything. Reports of the uprising horrified British society. The sheer scale of the violence, and the moral power of Sharp's nonviolent stand, helped push Parliament into action. Just 2 years later, the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833 was passed, signaling the official end of slavery in most of the British Empire. Sharp's blood had watered the seed of change. Today, Samuel Sharp is remembered as a Jamaican national hero. His statue stands in Montego Bay's Sam Sharp Square, facing the courthouse where he was tried. Schools bear his name. His life is taught as both a caution and a torch. He reminds the Caribbean and the world that faith and fire are not enemies, that the spirit can rise through sermons or sword, that even the gentlest voice, when guided by conviction, can shake an empire. He was a preacher. He was a rebel. He was proof that even silence, when broken at the right time, becomes revolution. 10,000 miles from Parliament, in the hills of post-emancipation Jamaica, freedom was a lie wrapped in a British flag. Slavery had ended, but the people were still starving, still landless, still silenced, still criminalized for being black and poor. And from that injustice rose a man who refused to bow. His name was Paul Bogle, preacher, farmer, organizer, and revolutionary. He didn't seek war. He sought justice. But when the courts closed their ears, he opened the gates of history. Paul Bogle was born around 1820, likely in St. Thomas Parish. A landowner and Baptist deacon, he was educated, eloquent, and spiritually grounded, traits that earned him deep trust in his community of Stony Gut, a small village near Morant Bay. But trust wasn't enough. His people were suffering. Though Jamaica had abolished slavery in 1838, the structure of colonial power remained untouched. Former slaves were denied land ownership. Harsh laws targeted squatters and the unemployed. Fines were imposed for petty crimes. Taxes crushed the poor. And the justice system served only white planters and brown elites. In a land once soaked in chains, black life remained cheap. Bogle had had enough. He began organizing, preaching, educating. He built a grassroots movement grounded in cultural awakening, land rights, and political accountability. He even walked 50 miles to Spanish Town with a group of followers to present their grievances to the governor. They were ignored. And so he made a decision. If the law won't serve the people will confront the law. On October 11, 1865, Bogle led over 400 men and women into Morant Bay, marching toward the courthouse during a local trial. They arrived not as rioters, but as witnesses. But fear turned the moment to fire. A confrontation with the colonial militia erupted. Shots rang out. Protesters threw rocks. The courthouse was set ablaze. Officials fled. 7 people were killed, but what came next was worse. The British colonial government, terrified of another Jamaica-wide rebellion, responded with utter brutality. Governor Edward Eyre declared martial law in St. Thomas. Over 430 people were executed or murdered without trial, hanged, shot, burned alive. More than 600 were flogged, thousands of homes destroyed. Bogle was captured, shackled, and hanged on October 24, 1865. His body, a symbol of black resistance, was discarded like waste. But his spirit could not be buried. News of the Morant Bay Rebellion sparked a storm in Britain. Intellectuals like Charles Darwin and John Stuart Mill condemned Governor Eyre's repression. The brutality became a global scandal, and though Eyre was never tried, he was removed from office. But in Jamaica, Bogle's legacy grew quietly, like roots beneath fire. He was a martyr of land justice, a prophet of post-slavery resistance, a man who asked not for violence, but for voice. His rebellion didn't end oppression, but it exposed the rotten heart of freedom under British rule. He proved that emancipation without equity is still captivity. Today, Paul Bogle is honored as a national hero of Jamaica. His image graced the old Jamaican $10 bill. Statues of his marchers stand in Morant Bay and Stony Gut, eyes fixed on a future they never lived to see. He was a man of faith, a man of the land, and a man who chose to speak when silence was too dangerous. In every Caribbean courtroom that now hears the poor, in every Land Reform Act, in every protest against injustice, Paul Bogle still marches. Emancipation came, but for many across the Caribbean, it arrived like a thief. Quiet in the law, loud in the lies. On paper, slavery ended in 1834. In practice, the chains took new shapes. Indentureship, colonial taxation, land dispossession, labor codes, hunger. And in the decades that followed, Caribbean society entered a dangerous in-between, not quite enslaved, not truly free. A place where the illusion of liberty masked a deeper war. A war over dignity, identity, and survival. The freedom fighters of this new era did not rise with fire, but with pen, protest, pulpit, and culture. Their battlegrounds were schools, sugar estates, courthouses, and song. This was the aftershock of emancipation, a time of betrayal and rebirth. In Jamaica, after the death of Samuel Sharpe and Paul Bogle, colonial authorities doubled down. Former slaves were forced into apprenticeship, a thinly veiled continuation of slavery, forcing them to work without full rights. Planters manipulated contracts and denied access to fertile lands, while a corrupt justice system ensured that the poor stayed poor. The promise of freedom had been broken, but the resistance adapted. Freed communities began forming free villages, self-reliant spaces purchased collectively by ex-slaves with the help of Baptist missionaries and African elders. These villages, like Sligoville and Sturge Town, became hubs of cultural preservation, education, and farming. People planted cassava, built churches, taught their children to read, reclaiming not just their land but their cultural identity. This was rebellion without violence. Cultural resistance in its purest form. In Trinidad and Tobago, freedom arrived amid the rise of another system, indentureship. Thousands of Indian laborers were brought under contract to replace slave labor, leading to decades of ethnic division, labor exploitation, and new hierarchies. But again, resistance emerged. From figures like Tubal Uriah Buzz Butler, a Grenadian-born preacher who led oil field workers in the 1930s, fighting against British corporations and wage slavery. His movement, infused with Pan-Africanism, class struggle, and spiritual protest, paved the way for modern labor rights across the Caribbean. This was no longer just a fight about race. It was a fight about power. Meanwhile, in Barbados, Grenada, and St. Lucia, the plantation economy persisted, but so did the pressure. Former rebels became teachers, unionists, and organizers. Cultural storytelling, through calypso, dub poetry, and folklore, carried the voices of the past into the ears of the next generation. Songs replaced swords. drums replaced declarations. But the resistance never stopped. By the early 20th century, new leaders began to rise. They wore suits instead of spears, spoke in parliament instead of battlefields, but they carried the same fire. Marcus Garvey, born in Jamaica in 1887, became the greatest voice of Black pride and Pan-African revolution in Caribbean history. His movement, the UNIA, Universal Negro Improvement Association, awakened global consciousness in Black communities, reconnecting the struggles of the Caribbean with those of Africa, the Americas, and beyond. Garvey reminded Caribbean people, "You might not be in chains anymore, but if you still don't own your land, your labor, or your history, you are not free." His message was met with surveillance, sabotage, and imprisonment, but never silence. So this chapter, this aftershock of so-called freedom, is not a footnote in Caribbean resistance. It is the bridge between plantation rebellions and modern revolution, between cutlasses and consciousness, between fire and formation. It shows us that betrayal can birth clarity, that oppression can evolve, but so can the struggle. The freedom fighters of this era were less remembered, but no less vital. They taught us how to resist with culture, how to survive with dignity, how to fight without falling into the traps of colonial revenge. They were farmers, teachers, union leaders, seers, preachers, and parents who whispered to their children, "Never forget who you are and what we survived." They left no palaces, no marble statues in London, no medals or monuments in the halls of empire. But their names are written in rivers, their courage carved into coastlines, their stories sewn into skin. From Otway's flames in Cuba to Paul Bogle's footsteps in Morant Bay, the freedom fighters of the Caribbean didn't just rise against slavery, they built the foundation of what it means to be Caribbean. To be free. To be whole. To belong. And that legacy is still alive. Walk through Kingston, Port of Spain, Bridgetown, or Castries today and you'll feel it. In the drums at a street corner. In the patois on a bus. In the dreadlocks of a schoolteacher. In the resistance of a child who refuses to bow. These are not accidents. They are echoes. Because the Caribbean spirit is not passive. It is forged in the memory of rebellion. It is taught not just in books, but in ritual, rhythm, resistance, and resilience. It's in the maroon trails that still snake through the Blue Mountains, in the ancestral chants at a nine-night wake, in the rice and peas on Sunday, seasoned with memory and survival. This is cultural preservation through lived resistance. Modern Caribbean nations, though still grappling with inequality and post-colonial trauma, carry within them the DNA of the very rebels we've chronicled. Queen Nanny lives in every woman who leads with fire and ancestral wisdom. Toussaint Louverture lives in every political voice that dares to challenge the system. Bussa and Cuffy live in every farmer who fights for land rights. Samuel Sharp and Paul Bogle live in every teacher who plants truth in the minds of youth. And the newer generations, poets, artists, musicians, activists, are not disconnected. They are the descendants of revolution. When Bob Marley sings, "Get up, stand up, stand up for your rights," he is translating Nanny's battle cry into sound. When Caribbean youth wear dreadlocks, speak Creole, reclaim their names, resist Eurocentric systems, they are continuing the resistance by other means. This is not nostalgia. This is narrative survival. Across the diaspora, in Brooklyn, Brixton, Toronto, and Amsterdam, Caribbean people continue the fight. Against racism, against erasure, against economic oppression, the battlegrounds have changed, but the struggle remains rooted in the same historical soil. From Pan-African summits to dance hall stages, from UN speeches to corner shop debates, the spirit of the freedom fighters marches on. They taught us that freedom isn't a moment. It's a movement, a constant act of cultural defense. And the tools of that defense, memory, music, language, land, love, legacy. This documentary has not just been a history lesson. It is a mirror, reflecting who we are and where we come from. To remember these fighters is not only to honor the past. It is to arm ourselves for the present and to dream the future with clarity. Because we are their unfinished story. Their breath. Their boldness. Their blood. And the next chapter? We are writing it now.